Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This week, we're talking about the one and only Vic Edelbrock. This guy's got a crazy story. Moved out from Kansas as a young guy, moved to L.A. and started making a shop. And by the time he was 25, he had like an established business. He was one of the OGs of the SoCal hot rodding scene back in the early 30s.
You've definitely seen his name on air filters or performance parts on muscle cars.
Absolutely.
The company's been around forever, and it's a really cool story.
Yeah, really cool story. Bart's in the studio.
Good to be out of that El Salvadoran prison, I'll tell you that.
Oh my God. Let's get into it. Imagine growing up as a poor farm kid in Kansas, and by the age of 30, being one of the most respected names in the SoCal racing scene. From navigating rough farm roads and Model Ts, to pushing the boundaries of V8 performance down a dry lake bed at over 100 miles per hour, one man did it all, and the mark he left on American horsepower is simply immense. Like a lot of America in the 1920s and 30s, this hardworking individual moved west at a young age in search of a better life. He struggled to make ends meet, yet slowly but surely forged his path. And, with a lot of determination, curiosity, and love for all things horsepower, became synonymous with an industry he grew to love so deeply. This is the story of Otis Victor Edelbrock, who, besides having one of the most old-fashioned American names ever typed onto a birth certificate, would come to be known as Vic Edelbrock Sr., a legend of American horsepower. But what got Vic Edelbrock into a pair of greasy overalls in the first place? Why did he move to Los Angeles? What led to him running a successful shop that kept expanding and expanding? And finally, what made his company's foray into the aftermarket performance so successful? Well, we're about to find out. It's Past Gas on Edelbrock. Welcome back to the show, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Across from me is Bart Bidling Meyer.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And to my left, it's Joe Weber. What's up?
What's up, Carbureted Nation?
Nice. Okay, so Edelbrock, a name.
Yeah.
This is a big name.
Yeah.
I'm surprised we haven't covered him yet.
It's been a long time coming. I think my first exposure, maybe with everyone else too, is just like the huge air filter on muscle cars.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Says Edelbrock. Yeah. But they make a lot of stuff, and they've been around for a really long time. I didn't realize. Yeah.
I remember seeing their ads, like watching Power Block growing up on Spike TV. Their ads with I think Edelbrock Jr., his son, right?
Yeah.
Right. Oh, I thought you meant it was a special program called Edelbrock Jr.
Edelbrock Jr.
And you put it on like on your go-kart.
Yeah.
It's like tiny Plenums kids in button-up shirts with really clean engines. So what I did with this engine was... apparently...
did you port that?
No, I'm really.
It's funny. Like
he's got a 13-to-1 compression ratio.
I'm almost 13 months. I think it's really funny. Sorry to go off on kid tangents, but when kids
that's a rapper name too.
Kid tangents. Oh,
kid
that's
tangents.
A good one,
dude. That's good.
Yeah. Kid tangent.
Yeah.
Sick. Okay. Sorry.
When kids get really cocky about the things they know, and they make the other kid feel really bad for not knowing, but it's like. Basic human stuff. Yeah. And then you see that happen and like, you know, guys our age.
I'm still working through that. I'm still trying to not be like that. I remember my friend Marley, I was trying to impress him at lunchtime one time when I was like, we're probably in first or second grade. And I told Marley that I was a black belt in Kung Fu.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Were you at the time? That's no. really young to be a black belt.
Yeah, I know. In retrospect, not a very convincing lie.
Do you think he bought it or no?
No, I don't.
He just let you go with it?
He's very smart, so nice. Probably didn't. So even at that age, he
But he didn't say anything because he's a cool dude.
Right, exactly.
I had a friend, Matt Regan, who was telling people that his dad designed the stairs in GoldenEye. And no one ever questioned it.
That's such a brilliant...
That's why I love it. That's a great lie.
Why would you make that
And
happen?
How would you ever
yeah.
check that?
Yeah, that's great. That's like the perfect kind of like...
And he's probably telling a story. He's like, but no one believed me.
Yeah.
Like his dad really did the stairs in GoldenEye. And
his everybody's dad just like, okay.
Yeah, did he work at Rare? Yeah. His face is like pasted on to his head. Yeah.
We watched the Minecraft movie.
Oh,
really?
It's really, that's actually, yeah. I was really surprised at
Did people do that chicken jockey was. Thing in your theater?
No. No, we didn't, it was like the matinee. It was like at 10 a.m. to the kids. But then afterwards, my son was like, you know what? How people talk about movies? And I was like, what? At my school, how people talk about movies. I'm like, well, how do they talk? And he goes, well, first you say, do you know? Then you say the movie or show. And then they say either yes or no. And then if they say yes, you can ask them, do you remember that? And then you ask them, then you say something you remember.
Mm-hmm. That's like, really cute.
All right. So like, how would you do that for this? Do you know the Minecraft movie? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Do you remember when the zombie baby was riding the chicken? I do remember that. Yeah. So that's how you talk about movies.
Okay, good.
That's really good.
Yeah.
He's like breaking down the whole structure of a conversation. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And then he can just plug and play.
That's exactly right. Well, what I thought was so funny was like, as he was describing to me, he's like, so first you say, do you know? And then the movie or show. You know, like he's doing it. So,
I love that. It makes it really easy.
Yeah, it sure does.
Plug and play, dude.
I heard that most of like the funniest lines in I Think You Should Leave were things that Tim Robinson's kids just said.
My dad.
Like, I think for 30 seconds, I thought monsters were on this world.
I thought that.
All right, shall we get into
it? Let's get into it.
Young Vic was born on August 16th, 1913, to Nelson and Margaret Edelbrock in Eudoria, Kansas. Times were tough for the Edelbrock family. Between raising three boys, Vic being the youngest, and living as impoverished farmers, life was a constant sun up to sun down, hard work in the fields, and devoid of any luxuries. Every waking hour was devoted to work. When able to, Nelson took small side jobs working in nearby oil fields to help support the household. Eventually, Nelson and Margaret saved up enough money to buy and run a small grocery store in the mid-1920s. Their business was successful, but sadly, disaster struck in 1927 when it was lost in a fire.
Oh, no.
The whole family ventured out looking for work, with Vic ended up working at a small dealership and auto shop at the age of 13, delivering Ford Model Ts to customers.
As one does at 13.
Yeah. Delivering Ford Model Ts to customers in the area.
I love it.
So you buy a brand new car. And
13-year-old
yeah,
delivers
a 13-year-old
it
drops it off. Yeah.
And he gets out and he has like baby blocks taped to his feet. Yeah.
While on the job, he not only learned how to traverse the rough farm roads behind the wheel, but also do side of the road fixes. And Vic really enjoyed the work.
Yeah. I like, it's like you're dropping the car off and you already have to fix it.
He's breaking it on the way there.
You know, this made me think of, I drove my mom's Mercury Grand Marquis when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we were on a normal street and she was like, you can drive like two blocks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just took Mark out in the slingshot to teach him how to drive manual.
Yeah.
And that scared the shit out of me. Just like being on these streets.
Yeah. Well, these are, people.
My mom trusted me to like a 12-year-old to drive a 22-foot car.
Yeah. Well, the thought. For a long time in America, the thought was the bigger the car, the safer you are.
Yeah.
So your mom probably felt pretty safe in Grand Marquis.
Good luck, everyone else.
Vic's skill set grew, and he even picked up extra income on the side running moonshine for local bootleggers. Had his father had his father ever found out about his run and shine, it might have put an abrupt end to his fascination with cars, which means we wouldn't have the Edelbrock brand as it is today. His fascination for all things automotive expanded, and he even made a name for himself as a local handyman who could fix other people's cars when they broke down. When 1930 arrived, Vic's eldest brother Ross took off for Los Angeles in search of a better life. Soon after, in 1931, Vic, his other brother Carl, and Carl's wife hopped in Carl's 1920 Studebaker and followed suit.
That's a pretty fancy car to have.
1920.
In Kansas.
Yeah, Eudoria? In Eudoria?
Dude, think it. Imagine yourself. You're in Eudoria.
Yeah.
You got to be one of the only Studebakers in town.
I wish I were in Eudoria.
I keep getting, like all these like for the love of old houses Instagram accounts where you can buy like beautiful
save
Victorian.
Yeah.
And they're always in places like Eudoria, but it's like
Central Ohio,
$229,000 for a 13 bedroom mansion with like intricate woodwork. Yeah. And it was like the richest man's house back then. But now it's like, if I had a job I could do remotely, I would consider it.
Who wouldn't, you know? But unfortunately, I have to look at your not unfortunately, but for this job.
What the hell, dude?
I'm just saying, unfortunately for you, I have to look at your in your eyes when we do this podcast, so you can't move. It'd be very hard to do this job remotely.
Way to reframe that.
Yeah. That's you know that's not what I meant.
No, I'm just giving you shit.
I also like that, Nolan, you said, I have to look in your eyes so you can't move, as though your eyes are that transfixing.
Like at Squid Games.
That you can't move.
He's like the doll in Squid Game. Yeah. He'll shoot us if he's just moving. This is how he runs donuts.
That's true. All right. They're going out to L.A. When Vic and Ross arrived in L.A., the car scene was already roaring. It was quickly becoming not only a haven for the automobile, but for racing as well. You had woodboard tracks in Playa del Rey, Culver City, and Beverly Hills that drew crowds by the thousands.
That was a really... Remember we went to a rich dude's secret garage off of La Brea?
Uh-huh.
So we were at his garage, and he had a picture of the Beverly Hills flat track.
The Coliseum was super sick.
It was really crazy.
Yeah.
And now NASCAR does races in the Coliseum.
It's in the Coliseum.
Yeah.
So with all these tracks, there's no shortage of wheel-to-wheel action all over the Los Angeles basin. Helping foster its growth was the Humble gas station. Back then, rather than being owned by major oil companies, private owners opened them much like any other small business today, become a retailer of certain brands, and offer accompanying services to make more money. The concept of the gas station and repair shop grew, and this is where Vic ended up, wrenching on customer cars. Like he did a few years prior in the fields of Kansas, his reputation grew as a skilled, quick-learning wrench. But he wanted more. He lived with his brother and sister-in-law in a small apartment and barely made enough to get by. Despite there being plenty of work in his industry, this was the Great Depression after all. He took a second job as a valet at a high-end apartment building in downtown LA and slowly saved up some money. He built up a reputation here, too, performing small fixes for residents and getting paid handsomely in tips.
That's pretty sick.
He enjoyed his busy work life, but he knew that if he ever was going to truly make something of himself, he had to open his own shop.
I think Daniel Mack, we had Daniel Mack on the Big Three. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who goes up and...
what do you do?
What do you do for work?
They're always like, I sell NFTs or some bullshit. But we asked him what was the big theme throughout all these people who own really cool cars. And he said, owning your own business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Owning real estate.
Yeah. He said a lot of doctors, a lot of like lawyers and stuff, but they also have their side hustle, which is a company they own or something like that, which is why I'm launching Athleisure for Dogs.
Athleisure for Dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, dogs already have sweaters that you can buy for them.
Yeah, but they don't have...
Don't shit on his idea, Nolan.
No, I'm just saying. This is great. Him.
They don't have...
Casual wear.
Form-fitting...
Yeah, dogs, I'm sick of either... When I'm looking for clothing for my dog, it's either a tuxedo or just schlub stuff.
Or like an Elvis outfit.
And it's like I'm embarrassed
sometimes
with how shitty my dog looks in these bulky pants.
There's a reason why they walk like this when you put... like little shoes on, it's because they look bad.
Yes.
If you had some like red bottom Louboutins, say,
I think you're onto something, Joe.
Some big Saucony sneakers.
Some Brooks for your dog.
Some Brooks for your Frankenweenie.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think they would be as embarrassed walking down the street.
No.
Especially if you live in LA and you're wearing athleisure.
Yeah. Your dog's gotta have that shit on too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what if the groomer appointment is a week away and your dog looks just like bloated?
Yeah.
And you need something just to kind of like fit the form.
Right.
Slim them down a little bit.
I like it.
Yeah.
Do you have investors?
Pupletics.
Pupletics.
I'm talking to Mark Cuban about it.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
He said, stop tagging me.
Well, one day while out sourcing parts for a customer's car in 1933, Vic happened upon a haggard service station with a for rent sign near Venice Boulevard and Hoover Street, just a bit west of downtown LA. To his amazement, the owner wasn't asking much. They made a handshake agreement, and Vic finally went into business for himself. As part of their agreement, the owner took care of manning the gas pump while Vic ran the shop.
What?
How about I rent from you when you work for me?
Well, no, I think the guy, it's a gas station, and the guy's not a mechanic. Mm. So he's like, you can rent my
shop.
Mechanic shop. Yeah. I'm still going to run my station.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying. That makes a lot more sense than what I was thinking. I was thinking Vic's working at a gas station on this other part of town, and the owner for the building is going to go do his job while Vic rents from
That's
him.
That's a hell of a handshake agreement.
What?
Like pulled the heist of the century on this guy.
Yeah. So Vic was prepared enough. He started assembling his own collection of tools rather than using his now former employers. And now, after years of working for others, he was finally ready to go into business for himself and earn as much money as he could and play by his own rules.
How's a love?
No shoes on in the shop.
Oh, God. I meant to bring this up a couple weeks ago, but have you seen the video on Instagram of Lars Ulrich in the studio with the mixers, and then one of them rolls back in their chair and they roll over his toe and he's like, ah, don't ever do that. And the guy's like, don't put your shoes on in the studio.
When Vic moved in, the place really needed work. It was filthy and sitting dormant for some time. So he went to work cleaning, organizing, and building workbenches and storage cabinets. One day, a boy from the neighborhood by the name of Bobby Meeks came by to watch out of curiosity.
That's such a boy from the neighborhood name.
Bobby Meeks.
Bobby Meeks.
Since the shop hadn't seen any activity in a while, Vic asked Bobby if he wanted a job helping cleaning everything up. He obliged, and Meeks became his first employee. Meeks remained Edelbrock's employee for many, many years, and under his tutelage became a legendary hot rod builder responsible for some of the industry's most significant developments of the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
And when Edelbrock was done with him, he became known as Bobby Strong.
Robert Strong.
While ferrying cars around the apartment complex in 1931, Vic met Katie Collins, an Irish immigrant who worked in the building as a maid, and they instantly fell in love. At the time, she was engaged to another man, but their instant chemistry must have really been something, as Edelbrock and Collins married just 8 weeks later in a courthouse down in Santa Ana.
The other guy wasn't even off the boat from Ireland.
Jeez.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
They remained together for the rest of their lives, and she eventually took a job in Beverly Hills as a nanny for Grace and Gus Kahn, famous songwriters of the era. Katie's brother Wes also became good friends with Vic, and they later worked and ran hot rods together. Wes is a cool name.
Wes Collins.
Wes Collins, dude. Speaking of hot rods, it was only a matter of time before Edelbrock's interest in all things automotive led him to modifying and improving cars for competition.
And then he just stopped. He was like, no, I'm not going to be good at this.
The end.
That is a short episode. Yeah. Huh. Oh, my dang.
As time went on, Vic and Bobby made a name for themselves. They delivered top-quality work and never turned down any job, whether it was repairing a wagon, performing normal maintenance, or completely rebuilding an engine. Vic Edelbrock Jr. was born in 1935 as well, which led the family moving to a small stucco house near the shop. After moving to another shop for a brief period of time, 1937 proved to be a major turning point for Vic's career.
It must have been significantly stuccoed if it was mentioned in anything.
Well, I mean, a lot of the houses out here are stuccoed.
You know what I can't stand is popcorn ceilings. My first house that I moved into had popcorn ceilings, and I was in kind of an attic room,
mm-hmm.
and my bed was...
Did you scrape your head on it?
Scrape my head so many times.
Really?
On the popcorn ceiling. Wow. Yeah. I also didn't realize that you were supposed to tip the AC unit out so that it dripped out, and then it kept dripping in, and I was like, what's going on? Why? And so my solution was to put a garbage bag there, and then I didn't empty it for like a whole summer, and so I had this like maybe 30 gallons of like, and I was scared to move it.
Yeah, that's heavy.
That's really heavy.
I can't believe it, Joe.
There's also, I was wrestling with my roommate, and
wait a minute. That's its own statement.
Okay, wait. Yeah, you're wrestling.
We had a special move called the popcorn.
Soren? I met Soren.
He was my roommate, but there was no divider in the room, so we just hung up a sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would leave Odyssey, 2001 in Odyssey.
Yeah.
On
Space Odyssey.
The DVD playing all night. He would watch it to go to sleep.
And then it'd start over?
That was on the menu.
Okay.
And he slept through it, and so I got so pissed, and like I brought it up, and he brought up other issues that I had, which were...
You're trash bag with 30 pounds of water in it.
And we started wrestling, and one of us got pushed into drywall, and it caved the drywall in.
Because it was so saturated with water.
For some reason, we started putting trash in there.
No!
And then he covered it up with a poster at some point.
No!
It's like the worst version of Shawshank Redemption.
So then
the warden gets there and it's just trash.
Then we hear skittering in our walls.
Wonder why.
And there was a whole family.
It was our downstairs roommate.
Yeah, he was crawling up the side. He was like, I couldn't take the stairs.
There was a family of raccoons that were eating the trash in the walls.
God.
It's like, so it's less that he was throwing things out. It's more that he was feeding raccoons.
No, I was definitely throwing stuff out. Yeah.
Yeah, but they were in the wall eating it.
We didn't know that they were in the wall.
I know, but anyway.
What the
Boy, that's great.
Yeah, what was just the rest?
Well, it was like because we sat, he had like, his mattress on the ground.
Yeah.
And we would play Gran Turismo we would do the endurance races. And since you couldn't pause, you have to like switch off.
Yeah,
and so we would spend all night playing this endurance race.
Yeah.
And I think it got brought up during one of these like overnight races. Like, and it was like, oh, and it was
escalated.
More just like pushed into the drywall. But that was not regulation because it was like this far in between boards.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, the studs. You didn't have studs.
Yeah.
Where people are like, they don't build them like they used to.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good thing.
Probably good.
Yeah.
Because I've seen how they used to build them.
Yeah. So anyways.
Wow.
Stucco house.
That's enough about that. Ceilings.
You're going to drop that?
When you were saying, when you started saying like we were wrestling, I thought it was like a thing you guys did.
Yeah.
And you were going to say like,
Thursday night, which was wrestling night.
My signature move was the popcorn face scrape.
No, it was more like gentle shoving.
You got into a little bit of a tuffle. Yeah.
We also bought a pool table that completely destroyed the, like, our only good room that we could hang out in.
Because it took up the whole room.
Yeah, and it was useless because there was about 14 inches on either side.
God.
And so everything was like that.
Yeah.
And then that ruined the pool table because you're just jamming it into the felt.
That's terrible. Oh, my God. Man. Joe, yeah. The more I learn about you, you're just like...
The less I like you.
No, that's not true. The more I like you. That's like the craziest... You had a colony of raccoons. Like,
but yeah. that's what getting to L.A. is, right? You come here with
sometimes you got raccoons in your wall. Sometimes your parents... Grocery store burns down.
Yeah. Where in town was this, that this apartment was?
I don't think I took you there, but it was off of Brady Street, Arlington and Brady.
Arlington?
It was east side.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sorry. So the major turning point in Vic's career was that his landlord decided not to renew the lease.
In that garage.
Right. Yeah.
After he cleaned it up. Dingus.
Hired Bobby Meeks.
So we were thinking
typical landlord move, huh?
Landlord was the one getting heisted.
No.
It was Vic.
Yeah, so this put him in a tough spot. Would he be able to afford moving to and running his business in a new shop? Would his customers follow him?
No. The end.
Thankfully, with a little luck, he was able to move into another shop not too far west at Crenshaw and Venice. Katie's brother, Wes, joined Vic as an employee. And fortunately, the West Side's economy was stronger, with newer and higher-end automobiles running up and down its streets. Combined with loyal customers following him, the shop's income grew substantially. This also got him closer to the SoCal motorsports scene. Venice Boulevard was a beacon for the industry, with other shops, clubs, and racers all gravitating towards it. Racers would stop in to have work done and regale Vic with tales of competition on the board tracks and dry lake beds. Vic spent all of his free time tinkering and modifying engines and components, improving them in ways he thought they ought to be, such as improving air and fuel flow, and in turn boosting performance. His engineering brain was hard at work. Vic's rise coincided with one of the golden ages of hot rodding. The nearby Mojave Desert was home to several massive dry lake beds. You had El Mirage, you got Rosamond, Harper, Evans, and Muroc.
How many of those have you raced at?
None. I think El Mirage is the only one that's still in operation like that. That's only like 2 hours from here. The latter, now the location of Edwards Air Force Base, originally started out as a magnet for the borax mining industry. Borax has a wide variety of household uses, but it is also utilized in refining gold, copper, silver, and lead alloys. When the mining industry left the area, in its wake was a big, open, smooth, flat expanse of land measuring 20 miles long and 10 miles wide, where anyone could go and do anything and not be bothered by civilization or the cops. Yeah.
The desert cops. Was it borax that they made like the slime? In school,
yeah,
it was like glue and borax, right? But it's also a detergent.
It's close to pH neutral, but it's a little bit basic. So it helps to soften the water and improve what your soap does. So it's not really the soap itself, and you can use it with different things like Castile. So like you can make your own, and it's something that's going to help the performance of your soap.
But it was your favorite brand of. Borax, and why is it 20 Mule Team?
I was going to say, I like they 20 use, Mule Team.
It's, yeah. Well, it's, I know. The brand is Borax. But I prefer the 20 Mule Team from Borat. the Borax, the 20 Mule Team is because they would pull so much of the Borax that they used 20 mules to pull it.
Wow.
To transport the Borax from the
desert to the plant?
Yep.
Oh. Learning so much.
Wait, Borax is a brand?
Yeah.
20 Mule Team is like just Kleenex. Like them. Okay.
This dry lake became a mecca for dry lake racing, the precursor to drag racing. One of Vic's friends and customers worked in the film industry as a stuntman. When he was injured on set in a motorcycle crash, he was out of work for a while and was forced to sell his 1932 Ford Roadster. Seeing this as the perfect opportunity to dig into performance tuning, Vic took it off his hands and got to work. He rebuilt the flathead V8, increasing compression, and he ported the manifold for better intake flow. He then fabricated better flowing headers and bolted three Winfield carburetors up top.
Nice.
Himself, Bobby, and Wes took it out to Muroc, and the thing performed incredibly well. Vic became obsessed. His intuitive, meticulous, curious, and hardworking mind dived deep into all things tuning, continually modifying his setup and starting to make a name for himself out on the lake. he met and befriended fellow racers, including Wally Parks,
hey.
Who 20 years later would form the NHRA. He also worked with fellow curious engineering minds, such as the Spalding brothers, who pioneered early high-performance ignition systems. And with their help, the 32's flathead revved as high as 6,500 RPM, nearly 2,000 more than it could in stock form.
Wow.
Again, he's like 25 at this point. Around the time Vic became more and more active in the scene in the late 30s, car clubs started popping up, which was a new concept for the era. The idea was not only to share camaraderie, but also knowledge and experience to help each other build better and faster cars. Clubs such as the Roadrunners, which was Vic's club, you had the Gophers, the Low Flyers, the Gear Grinders.
These are great.
Sidewinders, Ramblers.
Nice.
Hollywood Throttlers.
Oh, yeah.
The Night Riders.
Yep.
The Rattlers.
Yes.
The Centuries. And the Bungholers.
Great.
Good. Cool. No notes.
Clubs met up and started racing for bragging rights, and eventually the action spilled out onto public roads. Once street racing became a thing, the general public and media and local law enforcement viewed it quite unfavorably, as it often resulted in bloody wrecks and sometimes involved innocent bystanders.
You're all outlaws, except for those boys in the bungholers. They stop and let grandmas cross the street.
Clubs were quickly viewed as ne'er-do-wells, misfits, and generally unsavory individuals. SoCal law enforcement clamped down hard, threatening to take away access to the dry lake beds and killing off racing.
But hold on. If they're unsavory, then they're sweet. Right?
Yeah, I suppose that's an interpretation.
Thankfully, prominent members of the community got together to found the Southern California Timing Association, or SCTA, an organization that created bylaws, classes, and hosted events. Street racing calmed down significantly. In pursuit of horsepower and speed, Vic decided to start offering his modified parts for sale. He'd found some limitations with the ones he was bolting onto his own car, specifically its Thixton manifold, and took it upon himself to start experimenting with runner lengths, plenum sizes, diameters, and so on. Yeah. Lots and lots of
this
trial and error
interesting, yeah.
followed. Yeah,
I always love watching, or just the idea of when you look at a manifold, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, can I make this flow better? And just yeah. simple little tweaks that people do. So I think it's pretty cool.
And it's not like he had a degree or anything. He was just kind of experimenting with one piece at a time.
One thing will work. Yeah, what'll work, what won't.
And it was like this Rubik's Cube of, yeah. well, no, I affect that. No, this thing is out of whack or whatever.
Something I want to do on the go-kart that we were building, we like upgraded the engine. We put like higher compression piston and head on it. I want to take the head back off and like port the intake mm-hmm. and exhaust ports. Yeah. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. Yeah. You'd be like a little Vic.
Yeah, dude. Just like him.
Maybe like a Bobby Weeks.
Bobby Meeks.
Bobby Meeks.
Once he perfected his formula, Vic did what any intrepid small business owner would do, or at least dream of doing. He moved to a bigger, newer shop to foster his plans.
What's the address of this new shop?
I don't have it.
Oh.
Here, in addition to normal everyday service and fuel pumping, he'd have more space for research and development and keeping stock of products. Located at La Brea and Oakwood in central LA, the shop became known as the Braywood Shop.
Yeah. Located at Oakwood, you had to take the 101 to the 5. Get off on the La Cienega exit.
A local company was enlisted to do metal casting, and Edelbrock, as we know today, debuted its first product in 1938. So, dude, he's 25 years old.
But remember, he started working at 13.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And also that picture of the woman with her kids from the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
that woman is 30 in that
yeah.
photo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So that's what people look like at that age.
Wow. So featuring an innovative Y-shaped manifold design, smooth and wide flow, and space for two carburetors to sit on top, it became an instant hit in the scene. Edelbrock exploded in popularity, with racers coming from all over the area to not only have their cars worked on, but also just to hang out.
I think a cool prequel idea would be like Fast and Furious, but during this era.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that'd be sick.
That'd be so
sick.
That'd
be really cool.
And then they'd be like stopping Nazis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't race. I got to punch a Nazi.
After finding out that the original casting company allowed another company to closely examine and measure Vic's manifold, he switched to another and business continued. Despite most Americans suffering through the Great Depression, the Edelbrock family was largely insulated from it, though Vic never got too comfortable. He still took on as much work as he possibly could, even if it was really minor. Change was happening, and fast. By 1940, the U.S. Army Air Corps closed off a large portion of Muroc Dry Lake for use in bomber training. The scene shifted to another dry lake, but it was only a matter of time before racing efforts across the board were greatly reduced. The American economy went into wartime production. The Braidwood shop was in full effect, now also home to Edelbrock Equipment Company. Throughout the era, a large percentage of racers in the LA area were of Japanese descent, and many of whom were Vic's customers. Major players in the scene, like Harry and Frank Morimoto and Suneo Tani Shiakuni, entrusted their racing rigs to his hands. And on the weekends, they all competed against each other, forming an even tighter bond. Once the war broke out between the Allied and Axis powers, Executive Order 9066 was put in place, which forced over 100,000 Japanese Americans into internment camps. This is one of the darkest chapters in American history. However, it's refreshing to know that Vic was on the right side of history. He and other members of the community looked after Japanese Americans' race cars, tools, engines, and equipment while they were interned, and once the war ended, helped them get back on their feet and back into the scene.
I didn't know up until a couple of years ago, but there's a lot of Japanese farmers up where you grew up. Because Chachi lives in Napomo, which is right outside of Santa Maria. And he's fixing up a theater in Guadalupe, which is like south of Pismo Beach.
It's one of the five cities, I think, or something.
There's a couple buildings with like Japanese figures on them. And I asked about it. And he's like, yeah, when the war broke out, all these Japanese farmers who had this whole area were just like abducted. Their farms, it was like imminent domain. The government took their farms.
I had no idea about
horrible
that.
Horrible shit, yeah. Wow. And then they never got the land back.
No, when it comes to Vic here and his stuff, like it could have just as easily been like, oh, I've got these race cars here. Might as well give them my friends or sell them or make some money off this situation. Yeah. So.
Pretty cool of him.
Good
too.
On him to not do that. During the war, millions of young men who qualified for service were drafted into the war effort. Additionally, production of new cars stopped across the board, and companies shifted production to building trucks, jeeps, tanks, munitions, and more. The racing scene was still going on early during the war, but it was pretty minor. Eventually, organized racing was fully banned by the U.S. government. Vic was deferred from service due to being married and having a child, but business slowed down. In the mornings, he'd head to the shop to fill orders and do admin work, then midday, pass off the baton to Meeks, still faithfully employed and doing plenty of his own tuning and racing.
So, you know when he hands that baton, his arm is like, ugh.
He's so tired.
Because he's so meek.
So Vic could head down to Long Beach and work as a welder on a military ship production.
Whoa.
Wow.
I didn't know that happened there.
Eventually, Meeks joined the Navy, and with the war effort having priority over basically all materials in the country, Vic was unable to continue manifold production. He closed down the shop and moved his business to a small garage in his backyard where he stored manifolds and did very minor work when he could.
The war was a danger to the manifold.
Oh, God. Man, I fold whenever you tell jokes.
Shut up. Once the war ended, organized racing returned, as did millions of American servicemen who were anxious to return to their normal lives. In Southern California, that meant there was a massive increase in spending for racing, and Vic was ready to accommodate it. In his free time during the war, he brainstormed and designed new products he could build and offer for sale. And once the war ended, Vic wasted no time making them a reality. He moved to his biggest shop yet at 1200 Vine Street in Hollywood.
1200 nice. Vine.
I'm trying to think of where that would be.
I'll tell you right now. 1200 Vine
what's
Street.
The cross street?
Hollywood.
It's like Santa Monica and Vine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Damn, you did nail it. There's a Taco Bell across the street. That's cool.
That's the most interesting part.
I'm just, let's see here. It's a Dollar Tree now? It's a Dollar Tree.
Oh, the Edelbrock Shack's now a Dollar Tree?
Oh, man.
Damn. Yep. So if you want to check it out.
But there's a plaque that says this Dollar Tree is across from the Taco Bell.
Yeah. That used to be the fourth shop that Edelbrock owned.
Damn, it's a Dollar Tree. Wow. So this shop had five stalls and plenty of square footage for repairing, building, and tuning hot rods, as well as parts modification and production. Motorsports saw a massive boom. In addition to racing in a straight line, circuit racing gained immense popularity as well, such as dirt track midget racers and roadsters that saw action on paved tracks and more. Very interesting. In 1949, he's 36 now. Vic had more business than he can handle.
I'm a little bit worried. I feel like you're starting to question your own success, Nolan.
I'm not very good at math.
He's 36.
You did that really fast.
Disney too.
Yeah, that's correct, though. Okay. In 1949, Vic had more business than he can handle and moved south to an even bigger shop at 4921 West Jefferson Boulevard.
That's near where your old apartment was,
I think,
right?
So, yeah. Where Edelbrock maintained its operations all the way into the late 1960s.
So he's like a mid-city guy.
He mostly is a mid-city guy. And you know what? Mid-city is hella underappreciated, underrated.
Yeah.
People want to move to the west side or the east side. East side being very trendy and cool, west side being just really nice. But you know what? Mid-city, I lived there for like 5 years and I
loved
it.
You got delicious pizza.
Got great, good food.
Yeah.
And also like very reasonable rent. But also you're only like a 20-minute drive from either the beach or downtown.
Yeah.
It's great. It's wonderful.
It is a great spot. There's a cool bar over there. It might not exist anymore, but it's called the Mid-City Yacht Club, which is kind of like a fun like, haha, yeah. We're in the middle of the city.
That's where it is. Okay.
There's no yachts here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Vic greatly expanded his high-performance manifold catalog and offered basically every service to machine, hone, and polish all components in the quest for more power, and hired like-minded staff to get it all done. They modified crankshafts and pistons, lifters, carburetor stacks, plus completely custom-made aluminum cylinder heads. Wow. Mm-hmm. There was no end to what Edelbrock made, as well as carried from other companies. The scene got bigger and bigger, and designated El Mirage Dry Lake as its premier drag racing venue. Well, it's more like a land speed venue. Along the way, Vic was there, not only to supply and help customers modify, but to take the wheel out on the dirt as well, walking the walk as much as he talked the talk. Yeah.
That was the Friendly Geordie's car review spoof. It was talk the torque, but in a his British accent, or his fake British accent, it was talk the talk.
Nice.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
When the late 40s and 50s arrived, there was a new game in town ready for tuners' greasy little hands. The Chevy small block, which is still a favorite among hot rodders and motorsports fans, it's still around today in LS and LT form and widely regarded as one of the most significant contributions to tuning and motorsports ever. Vic had not only been supplying customers directly, but also other shops all over SoCal. Up near Santa Barbara in Goleta, a racer by the name of Bob Jonick owned a small gas station and shop and carried Edelbrock products. He'd often drive down to Edelbrock in Los Angeles to procure stock and, while there, expand his knowledge of hot rodding. Street racing had been a thing up there, but it was Jonick who, with the help of his local car club, the Santa Barbara Acceleration Association, was able to rent a road at a local disused marine airfield. The distance they outlined was from between a white painted line and a nearby bridge, which came out to 1320 feet, a quarter of a mile.
And
thus,
that's how they figured out what a mile was.
This first time.
Yeah, they're like, let's quadruple this and then let base off our whole system off of that.
Thus, drag racing as we know it was born. The Chevy small block debuted in the C1 generation Corvette as an upgrade. Displacing 265 cubic inches and putting out 162 horsepower, it was a big increase in power over the standard Blue Flame inline 6. This power plant also proved potent with the help from a customer who worked for Chevrolet. Vic got his hands on a pre-production model.
Ooh.
Vic went to work with his normal strategy of porting, bumping displacement, and utilizing every other trick in the book for increasing horsepower. Additionally, he designed better flowing manifolds, custom cylinder heads, exhaust headers, and other parts that would garner more grunt as well. Eventually, he became known as the first builder to squeeze the most amount of power out of it. 285 horsepower to be exact, after bumping displacement up to 283 cubic inches. More than one horsepower.
So got an additional 80 horsepower out of 200. Yeah. That's
more than one horsepower per cubic inch, which was quite impressive for the era.
No, 120 horsepower.
What was it stock?
165 or something.
Oh, I thought you said it was
200. It was 265 cubic inches and putting out 162 horsepower.
Oh, 162. Wow. So we got another 120.
Jeez. Yeah.
Damn, son.
Almost doubled it.
I mean, it does help to get your hands on the pre-production.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's pretty cool you got in front of it.
Yeah.
And then it rolls out, and it's like, guess what?
I already got some cool shit for it. Just hit up Jonix in Goleta.
Yeah. Around this time, Vic Jr. was coming of age and taking it all in. He had been fascinated by hot rods, circuit racers, and the community that ran them since he was a boy. Just like his father, had showed massive mechanical interest. Like father, like son. However, he ran with a rough and rebellious crowd in high school. And to set him straight, Vic Sr. demanded he go straight to the shop from school to work for a few hours every day and then go home with him at night. It instilled some discipline and work ethic in Junior. I relate because I had to do that too in high school. I did. I'm done with school. Now I got to ride my bike.
I got to make 10,000 bolts for my dad.
Yep. Yep. Got to run that
mill. He was a bolt maker as a kid.
I remember.
Dang. Barely into the 1960s, Vic Edelbrock Sr. passed away at the age of 49 after a long and painful battle with lung cancer and lymphosarcoma.
Wow.
He was a heavy smoker his entire life, and it's what sadly did him in at too young an age. Post-diagnosis, even after growing very weak and near death, he still continued to work as much as he could, a testament to his immense work ethic and engineering perfectionism. Vic Jr. sadly passed away in 2017, but not before leaving his own significant mark on the performance industry. To name a few cool highlights, his manifold saw service in the International Race of Champions, better known as the IROC series. Offshore boat racers ran them during the sport's heyday in the 1980s, and even developed emissions-compliant performance manifolds when legislation seemed like it was going to put an end to aftermarket tuning in the 70s. He proved that efficiency is efficiency. Not only did his products increase horsepower, but cut down on pollution as well.
That's pretty cool.
He was a real advocate for the tuning industry early on and maintained this position until his passing. Not only that, but Edelbrock was one of the first companies to introduce aftermarket fuel injection for performance applications too, kicking off with its first ProFlow EFI systems in 1979.
Wow. That's early.
Yeah. I think that's right on the cusp of you know. He had products for the small block before the small block out. You know, so it's pretty crazy. He's right.
That's
on
like
the
right
edge.
When Porsche just started using like Jetronic and that kind of stuff.
To this day, Edelbrock still has the ProFlow line of EFI systems ready to accommodate a myriad of different high horsepower applications. It's crazy to think that a poor farm boy from Kansas could move to bustling Los Angeles and over the course of 30 years, build up an empire that became an authority on high-performance engine tuning. By the time he passed and Junior took over, Edelbrock offered hundreds of products for all major manufacturers. It didn't matter if it was Mopar, Chevy, or Ford. This company was dedicated to horsepower.
You won't find any Calvin peeing on stickers.
Calvin will never pee on Edelbrock.
Yeah.
Today, Edelbrock is
still... In fact, Edelbrock makes products for every kind of car that Calvin can pee on.
Today, Edelbrock is still a major player in the aftermarket, as well as a supplier to many OEM manufacturers. Those superchargers you see atop Lotus Evora and Amira V6 engines, those are Edelbrock. The company has several casting and R&D facilities around the country, employing a strong workforce as a top-tier supplier, and isn't slowing down anytime soon. It's changed and adapted with the times, but still adheres to the basic principles of offering high-quality, horsepower-boosting options for enthusiasts from all walks of life, all in the quest to reach the quarter mile a little quicker, turn a faster lap time, and find any edge on the competition.
Also, think of it's crazy that it's just a name, Edelbrock.
Yeah.
But as a logo... It is so recognizable and synonymous with everything.
You can just picture it in your head. Yep. And it is that air filter, too.
And it's cursive Edelbrock.
Yeah.
It's indelibly
even
part of it.
The Y-shaped culture. Manifold that was like his first invention. I can picture that in my head too.
Mm-hmm. Very cool logo.
It's just making a couple things really well. And
well, efficiency is efficiency. What a cool way to say it.
They don't make turbos though, right?
I don't think so. We got some listener mail this week. This is from Michael. Hey guys, couple things for you. Firstly, when you're talking about sponsorships in NASCAR, Nolan completely tanked on the perfect nickname of Nolan Lucky Sykes. I don't remember that, but I will take the L on that.
I don't understand what's perfect about it.
I don't know.
Look up Nolan Lucky. Oh, is it Lucky Strike?
Oh, like Lucky Strike.
Maybe. Lucky Sykes. It's pretty good. Also, just curious as to what y'all's scariest experience was while wrenching. Mine was when I was testing a Ford Econoline. I hit a bump in the road and heard a hissing sound. I looked behind me and saw red and green hoses. I freaked the f*** out and pulled over as fast as I could and started looking for a leak. Luckily, it was the oxygen and not the acetylene tank. It was a welding tank.
Yeah.
Oof. Peace, guys. Michael. Bart, what was your sketchiest, scariest experience while wrenching?
Was that while wrenching? That was while driving.
Yeah, that's driving.
I guess it's well, that opens it up to more.
You could be wrenching on the wheel.
I think it's like way different.
Oh, wrenching on.
Let's stick to the wrenching since that was his question.
But that would be pretty. That would be hairy. That'd be if you had
hairy. Yeah.
I've got one. Let Joe go ahead, first. Joe.
The first spare tire I ever switched was my family's 1990 Dodge Caravan, and I just used the jack that was in the kit in the back of the van. I didn't think it was that big of a deal to find a flat piece of road. And so I had it parked on the side of the road, but it was kind of one of those streets that was like convex. So it was slightly angled towards the curb. And I also put it up on the jack stand before loosening the nuts.
Is it passenger side or where was
this? This was passenger side.
Okay.
Sitting on the curb, I was like wrenching on these nuts, trying to get them loose.
It's a typical Joe story.
And I can't remember what happened, but when I was pulling the tire off, it jostled the car loose and it fell and the brake disc was like an inch from my foot.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And it just went doosh, and my uncle saw it and he goes, "Oh, that was close." Yeah. I'm not going to tell your dad, but
Also, thanks for the hand, Unc.
So that was my hairiest.
Yeah. For me, when I was with the funny car team, we were up in Medford, Oregon for a race. And you know, after every round the car comes back in and we turn it over basically, or like, you know, take the whole car apart, take the whole engine apart and service it. My job, I was on the bottom end, so I'd, you know, the car would go up on air jacks, pro jacks, up in the air. I'd get under there and start taking the oil pan off the car so we could start pushing the pistons out from the bottom. And I, you know, it was like a new track and like we were kind of on a rush and I totally forgot to take the drain the oil.
Oh God.
Right after
hot oil.
Yeah. It's a nitro burning car. Yeah. So it's a really hot engine.
Jeez.
I'm like undoing the oil pan. And as it comes off, like all the oil just like spills out. Onto me.
Oh no.
And it was like hot.
And luckily, that's why your face looks like this.
Yeah. So yeah, that was pretty bad. And
what happened?
I mean, it was f-ing hot.
But it was just on your clothes. Yeah,
luckily just on my clothes. I mean, I'm covered in oil for the rest of the event. Luckily it wasn't any hotter because that probably would have burned me if it was any hotter than that.
Temperature wise, how hot do you think it was?
Like a hot tub.
Oh, like that's like 100 degrees.
No, hot tub's like 150 degrees, isn't it?
No.
It was probably higher than that, and you couldn't feel how hot it was because luckily it landed on your coveralls. Right?
Yes.
Jeez, that's scary though.
I'd be scared of that.
It's not good. So I never forgot to drain the oil after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no like cooling on those cars. There's no radiators or anything. It's like whatever's
it's one and done.
Yeah, it's one and done. There might be a water tank in there on the back.
I understand how dangerous that is, but you need to know that 150 degree hot tub is going to cook you in a second. So don't ever turn your hot tub up to 150 degrees.
I don't know. I'm trying to sous vide myself.
Yeah.
Suicide.
That's really good, Noah. Yeah.
You're not missing any more opportunities with that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Bart, do you have a sketchy?
I was under a car. I don't remember. I think I was redoing brake lines under the Oldsmobile. And so it's up on four jack stands. And I got a text about the Harbor Freight recall.
Oh no.
Sorry. Well, it wasn't.
Could have been bad.
It could have been bad. But it was one of those like, oh shit.
The text is like, I'm getting out from under the car.
Yeah. I do. So
it wasn't like a close call or anything, but it was like, I did have a moment of like, ey.
I did have a buddy, my friend Austin, he was working on his, I think it was his Crown.
I have the four tires under the car.
Yeah.
Because that'll.
My buddy Austin has a Crown Vic that he like manual swapped, and like it's like a road racing Crown Vic,
that's
and he was
cool.
working on it, and the I think he forgot, or he was just had it up on the jack or something,
mm-hmm.
or the with no jack stands underneath, and the jack failed, and it like came down on him, it broke a couple ribs.
Oh god.
And like it was on he was laying on his,
how'd he get out, somebody
I
saw it?
Forget how he did. I think he had a buddy with him or something. But anyway, one of his ribs broke and got like within like a centimeter of like piercing his heart.
Oh. Yeah.
So like had it been any different,
that's
like
scary.
It could have like killed him instantly. Basically.
That's scary as hell.
Yeah. I think I'm.
So use jack stands, folks, and don't use cheap ones either. Invest in some good ones, some decent ones. It'll save your life, probably.
The ones I had, though, weren't the ones that were recalled.
Oh, that's good.
So it was like, again.
That's good.
And also remember when they did the recall, they were like, don't use these. If you have them, return them, and then we'll give you these other ones.
Yeah.
And then, like, 2 weeks later, they were like, actually, don't use those either. If it's not a good month for Harbor Freight.
Jeez. All right, so on that note, thank you guys so much for listening. This was a fun one. Edelbrock, great story.
Yeah.
Follow Bart at BidsBardo on Instagram. Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Big thank you to our writer this week, Peter Nelson, friend of the show.
Hey, Peter J. Nelson.
My name is Nolan Sykes. Follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Thank you, John and Audrey, behind the scenes here. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.